Okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I'm Adam Wood from Morgan Stanley. Very pleased to have Adyen with us here in Barcelona today. I've got Ingo Uytdehaage, CFO of Adyen. Ingo, thank you very much for joining us, especially a little bit last minute. We really appreciate you coming over and making the time.
Thanks, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Perfect. Look, I wanted to start off. It feels as if there's a lot going on at Adyen at the minute. There's obviously been the acquiring business that the success has been built on. There's issuing, you know, platforms. We've talked about, you know, the embedded financial products that you've talked about since Capital Markets Day. Could you maybe just talk a little bit from your point of view, you know, what your focus is, what's keeping you busy, and the areas of the business that you're, you know, spending that time on?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think if you look at the current state of our business, we're in high investment mode, and not just in the new products. I can talk a bit about that in a minute, but also in the traditional products. If you look at, we've always been very strong in the core of payments. We've always been ahead of competition there, and we want to continue to be in that position. That's also why we keep on investing in new terminals, for instance, to make sure that retailers can optimize their customer journeys. That's also being on top of new innovations, like being a reliable partner to Apple to get to tap to phone, which we launched as one of the first globally. I think it's exactly this thing that you're on top of the newest innovations in payments that we need to continue. That's why we're in investment mode also on the core side of our business. Next to that, indeed, we spent a lot of time on building out embedded financial products. Again, that's also on the core of payments. Typically what you see is that a lot of platforms, they want to include payments to their offering. We are the right partner to work with them because we provide this in a white label setup. A very logical next step is to also offer different type of products on top of that. So if you have payments, and you can also add a bank account or capital or cards with our issuing product. And it's exactly that combination or that suite of products where we currently are investing in and also working with our customers to further, yeah, build out that product. And that takes time because also we build everything in-house. There is no reliance on third parties here. Also the way how we build our licenses. So that's why we take this approach.
So you mentioned heavy investment mode. That brings me on to the next question. There was an internal email that was shared with us that Peter sent out a few days ago, which contrasted you quite sharply with what's going on in a lot of the rest of fintech and tech in terms of investment and what's happening. Could you just talk a little bit about, you know, the rationale behind that email, making it public, and, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, you know, to share that?
Yeah, sure. So indeed, we sent out an email to the team to also give a little rest in the company because there's so much news and turmoil in the markets that tech companies are firing teams, and we are in investment mode. We've always been clear to the team that we are, and we want to reassure them that we continue to build also next year, that we will keep adding people to the team. Because we have always done that, I think we've always ignored a bit what's happening around us. I think how we've built the team quite consistently has always been a function of the quality of people. So can we get the quality that we want? And of course, the availability of people. And in the earlier years also, I think if we talk about a year or a year and a half ago, it was quite difficult to get talent in because it was super competitive. And then we, I think, hired less people than we wanted. And we're currently in a situation that is relatively easier to get talent in, but we don't lower the bar. So it's still making sure that we can absorb people in the company, that we can train them, that we keep the culture, because I think that's one of the key things why I think we are successful as a company is because we are very much focused on culture.
Right.
And I think that email is a reflection of what we wanted to say to the team. Like, it is culture first. It is about building a team. It's about building a team for the long term. And we ignore the short-term trends, what's happening around us. And we strongly believe we're not in a position that we're over-hiring. We believe that we're hiring in a very responsible and disciplined way, and we will continue to do so.
So, know, within that plan and that talk of the increased pace of hiring, you know, I think you talked a little bit about the plans into 2023 and into 2024. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about what the hiring plans look like in terms of whether that's a percentage of the business, absolute numbers? You know, what are the plans there in terms of how many people you want to bring in, and how long does that foot on the pedal keep going for in terms of investment?
Yeah, sure. If you look at the current hiring pace, we stepped up hiring in this year, so in 2022. The people that we expect to hire in 2023 is in absolute terms similar size. We want to make sure that we also in the future make sure that people can be successful in the company, that we can train them, that we can onboard them properly. We won't hire faster than this. At the same time, if you look then at after 2023, we want to make sure that revenues grows faster than the team again. Because I think that's one of the fundamental beauties of our business model, that revenues and costs are unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of operating leverage in our business. Basically from moving from like almost a single product company, only payments, to a more broader company, you need to have a certain moat in the business, like teams that are ready for it. I think that's the investment that we currently make. We go to a new level, and after 2023, we believe that we can outgrow revenues again and have more revenue growth than the team growth. That will also lead to expanding margins in the years after.
Just to be very clear on that, you talked about hiring at a similar pace in 2023 and 2022. Are you talking absolutely or as a percentage of the size of the business?
No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. In absolute people that we onboard, that will be similar in 2023 compared to 2022. Yeah.
Perfect. That's very clear. Thank you. Then within platforms, there's, you know, been quite some interesting developments on that side of things. Could you share a little about the opportunities specifically in the financial services space that you see on the platform side?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the most interesting future areas of development. If you look at the problem that a lot of platforms try to solve is that smaller companies are underserved by the banks. We've recently done a survey together with Boston Consulting Group, and I think about two-thirds of the SMEs, they strongly believe that they are underserved, that they are interested in financial products by platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Only, I think a few percent actually takes those products. There's a huge opportunity for us. The reason why is because a lot of the traditional banks, they have issues in providing loans or bank accounts or cards to SMEs because they think that the compliance cost is too high.
Right.
Onboarding a small merchant is relatively expensive. The key thing that we've built and what we've been focusing on also in our platform strategy is that we like to help platforms to accept payments. That's where it all starts. By onboarding all those sellers on our platform, we already do the KYC, so know your customer procedures. For all the, we basically have to do that also with all the licenses that we have. Because we have this information, it is very easy to make the next step and also provide a loan or a card or a bank account because we don't need additional information. We already have this information, so it's more a assessment of whether we think that such a seller is ready to get a loan. Other than that, we have the information, we can provide it. That's why we go into this area, and the platforms are very much interested in it to further increase their revenues. It's a huge revenue opportunity for them. Of course, our business model is to get a revenue split out of that. We want to provide. That's also our focus. We want to provide the technology behind this, being the white label partner behind it. That's how we wanna further grow this business.
Can we dig into that a little bit more? I completely get the KYC and the onboarding problem. As a consumer that's been onboarded by traditional banks.
Yeah.
I completely understand that problem. Are there other USPs that you bring to that in terms of how you operate the platform, the speed, the experience? What else does Adyen bring to that for those companies that's gonna be different from a traditional experience maybe?
Yeah. I think it is all about the full integration into the platform. If you're, let's assume, you're a spa software as a service company, and you provide software to spas where you can book your spa, also
then want to add payments to the mix, that we can provide them terminals. So it's not only the online booking, but also the terminals. And then as a next step, in their portal, you can, for instance, ask for a bank account, for a card, or for you can offer them a loan. So it's all in their customer environment. So it's very easy to build it in their customer experience.
Yep.
And we are the white label partner behind it. So they're just calling our APIs. So it's a seamless integration. I think that's the thing that we're looking for. That's also why we strongly believe that we're in a pretty unique position, also because we have our own licenses. So we're not dependent upon third parties that we need to work with. We have a banking license in Europe. We have a banking license in the US. So having this full flexibility creates a lot of options to be that long-term partner for platforms. And I think that's where we are uniquely positioned, also compared to other players in this industry that rely more on third parties or want to have more control over the relationship that they build with the seller. And in our situation, the seller has really a relationship with the platform. And of course, we do the legal requirements on the KYC side, but still the first line of contact is with the platform.
Now that makes sense. And what the experiences so far, because the thing that struck me was it can be a very efficient way for you then to distribute into many, many SMBs that would be quite hard for you to access if you were to try to build some sort of other direct model. How do you feel about those, you know, platforms, particularly some of the smaller ones, if I'm a SaaS company, their ability to sell payments and the bank accounts and lending into those end customers? How's that worked as a distribution channel so far? Has that been quite efficient or?
Yeah, well, it's of course a journey with those platforms to see like how they indeed can do that. I think on the payment side, we've a clear track record. I think it's also very logical to
right.
add it for those players. There is a lot of traction in that market. I think for the other products, it's currently a thing that we're working on with them, a couple of pilots. So it has to prove still that it works. But we strongly believe it will, also based on the research that we've done, the need that there is there in the market. In the next years, we will demonstrate that it actually will work. So the customer feedback is very positive.
Right.
And that's why we believe that this is the right path to go.
And the competition in the traditional acquiring space has been a lot of legacy banks, and we could argue it's the same in this space, but there are some other kind of tech forward companies that have thought about this area. Do you see the competitive landscape as very different to acquiring in terms of, you know, traditional bank versus more modern tech companies, or do you think it's a relatively similar landscape for you?
I think that there is not a lot of companies that are deeply investing in the technology
right.
behind it, and we're one of the few. And that's, I think, why we're uniquely positioned also to do that at a global scale in a single platform. That's what we don't see around us. And that will, in the end, lead to a lot of benefits, because if you work with a more also global type of platforms, they can run it out in multiple markets with us. And that's, of course, a huge benefit compared to more traditional players.
A global scale is such a gigantic market.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And then maybe just one final one on this side of things, on the risk profile. So we're talking about lending. How do you think about the risk profile of the group? Does the business start to look more like a traditional bank than a payments company as you move into this area?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think we've always been a technology first company. So we want to make sure that we provide the right technology. And we have always taken a very much risk-based approach to how much financial risk we want to onboard to the company. Also, when we were only focusing on the acquiring space, for instance, with airline acquiring, where you have relatively a higher risk if an airline would default, we've always been reluctant to onboard them. I think we take a very similar risk-based approach to lending. So we will continue want to be a fee business and not a balance sheet business. Of course, at the one hand, we want to make sure that this grows as quickly as we can. But if it becomes a sizable business, we are always looking at ways to offload that risk or share that risk with others. I think a lot of platforms are interested in getting a revenue share, so that also means a risk share. But of course, also other companies that actually are willing to take part of that risk. I think here, again, there is a lot of flexibility for us because we have our own licenses.
Right.
So we have a lot of flexibility to design it or structure it in a way that we can make the decisions based on the type of risk that we want to take. again, we're not doing this to increase the risk profile of the company. We're doing this because we believe we want to provide the right technology to the platforms, and be, yeah, and to a certain extent, risk-averse to high lending books, because that's not what we're really interested in.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So maybe this is kind of coming back slightly to the hiring question, but, you know, I've got a lot of questions from investors around the margin progression in the first half of the year, because it's
Yeah.
the first time in a while that the margins have come backwards. Could you maybe just talk a little bit, you know, was that, I think we've seen with a lot of companies, there was difficulties hiring in 2021. We were still avoiding COVID costs that maybe investors thought would come back into the businesses, but didn't. How much of that is a normalization of maybe a little bit of an inflated level versus, you said before, there's operating leverage in the business. Investors now are a little bit nervous. Is there really that operating leverage there? Are we in a period where margins need to come backwards for a while? Could you just help us understand what's going on the margin side?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a fair question, of course. Like, if you look at the pandemic years, cost base was relatively lower, no travel. It was more difficult to hire a team that we wanted also because the labor market was very competitive.
Right.
So in the first half, that basically went back to normal. So you could argue that the margins that we had in the early years were slightly higher than in a normal world. At the same time, if you look at the current state of business, we are heavily investing. We're not investing in lots of operational people to keep the business running. We're investing in engineers that build out the product, either in the new products or with platforms, but also in the traditional space, like the core of our payments, where we're still heavily investing. That combination of hiring mostly engineers, and the fact that we are investing in a broader product portfolio, also in more geographies, makes us believe that we are building, in the end, a bigger business. And therefore, on the long term, we will get back to that operating leverage. If people would force me to say, like, okay, we want to see 65% margin as of end of this year or next year, maybe end of this year is a bit difficult given it's November, but if we had to make 65% next year, we will. That's not a problem.
Right.
Problem is that, or the challenge is that we see such an opportunity globally that we want to take it. We are quite excited about the opportunity that's ahead of us. And at the same time, we want to build the company in a responsible way. So I agree, it's a bit of trust in management that we will execute well. But I think I can assure you that we are very, very disciplined in the way how we spend the money, how we hire the people, that we make sure that we build a sustainable company. We are also, as management, still highly involved, also a big shareholder ourselves. So
Right.
We want to do the right thing for the company. Yeah.
No, and the track record of building the company to where the margins are and the execution
Yeah.
of the IPO gives you some track record to reassure people on that. And if we think about next year, 2023, well, obviously we've got this normalization versus 2021 happening in 2022. But you know, if the UN's in there, that's in the base, the travel costs would then be in the base in 2023, and you're hiring absolutely the same number of people. It should mean that we, you know, we might not see the huge operating leverage, but we shouldn't see margins going down again in 2023. Would that be a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, I want to avoid to give like short-term guidance because we,
Yeah.
again, we're in that short or in this investment mode. Of course, it's not that we want to overspend right now and get to like a super bottom in our EBITDA margins. So I find it hard to say like, oh, if you look at the full year 2022, that's sort of the bottom of EBITDA margins, because there's always this effect. If you hire a lot of people in 2022, they fully come into the cost in 2023 because they're hired throughout the year. But fundamentally, like in the course, if we start to have revenue growth higher again than team growth, you will get to this expansion again. Yeah.
Now that makes sense. I think one of the themes, and we've been talking about this with a lot of companies, is around the macro situation, and you know, investors are obviously quite nervous about how that looks going forward. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about on the platform? You know, you have a great visibility into what's going on in the world with the number of volumes that's going through. What are you seeing on the platform side? Is there, we've seen some weakness in e-commerce, actually maybe not related to macro, but through the normalization of the world opening up again. Is there any help you could give us in terms of what you're seeing, you know, has macro impacted what's going on in the online world on volumes on the platform?
Yeah, so I think in all fairness, we've only published half year numbers. I think in half year numbers, that was really not noticeable. Of course, we see that the world is changing around us a bit. At the same time, if you look at how we've also covered ourselves for our own revenues, is that we, important part of our revenues is ad valorem. So if inflation kicks in and prices go up, it also means that it is reflected in our revenues. Most of our growth comes from working with our existing merchants, where we increase share of wallet. So our growth is not dependent upon how the world economy evolves, but about how much market share we win with our existing customers. And we have continued to work with our customers to get there. And I think we have a quite strong track record in getting more share of wallet. I can't say anything about the second half here, but yeah, we continue to reiterate our guidance and make sure that we will continue to grow with our merchants.
And that raises a really interesting point because, you know, to pick numbers out, if the in-store volumes, if the market's growing 5, online's growing 10 or whatever it's growing, and your growth has been well in excess of that, that delta is basically that incremental share of merchant wallet. Could you, I mean, again, from a macro point of view, does the macro environment change how you win share with merchants? Is there just a structural element to it? Because if you're executing better than other acquirers, the volumes just naturally come to you because the merchants route the volumes naturally to who's delivering the better service. Is there any change in that with macro, or is that just an ongoing structural trend?
I would say it's an ongoing strategy trend. Of course, there are a couple of things that help us right now. Like if you look at the success that we have in unified commerce. I think that's a very strong proof point. Like, if you realize that we only started with unified commerce about, or with point of sale, around 8 or 9 years in a serious way, it's currently around, I think, just below the 15% of total volume. The run rate of that volume in absolute terms is close to 100 billion right now. So if you look at end of half year, first half year, 100 billion was the volume that we processed for the full company in 2017. So if you think about that size,
right,
it says a lot about how quickly the point of sale volume on our platform is growing. And the reason why it's growing is because we've built a solution that is, from a technical perspective, way more advanced than what's around us. So most of the market in point of sale is still with traditional banks. They're not investing, they're not innovating in this area. So it's just the traditional dump terminals. And of course, if you ask us, like, what is the long-term future 20 years out of a terminal, maybe it will disappear over time because people want to pay in a seamless way. But that's exactly why we have it in the same platform, so that we can help merchants to transition to new customer journeys. But it is also a reason why we have so much traction right now, because we have terminals that are advanced, that are manageable from a distance, that are can be operated at a way lower cost than the traditional industry. And that's why we also see that more traditional players start to swap their terminals for our terminals. And we have this traction in the market.
So you recently announced your own in-house design POS.
Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about, you know, why and what the benefits are for a merchant that differentiates? What do I get as a merchant that's different with that?
Yeah, so like in the end, the terminal is a terminal. So what can be different? Well, there are some differences. Like I think that it has a few benefits to develop your own and design your own terminal. We're no longer dependent upon a single vendor, which used to be Verifone. We can actually work very closely with our merchants to say, like, okay, what are the specific requirements that you want to have in the terminal? To give a very simple example, like, we've built an Android terminal, and that Android terminal has, like, the right chipset in it to run the applications of our merchants on it. As if you would go to a really cheap terminal of another provider, it would still run Android, but with a very low chipset.
Right.
So it couldn't run that application of the merchant. That's, I think, an example where we want to make a difference. I think we try to improve the design a bit because most terminals still look quite clunky. And yeah, the feedback from our merchants is very, very positive on it. So, in the end, we're absolutely not intending to manufacture these things ourselves. We work together with our partners to do this.
Mm.
But designing it and thinking about the requirements, that's what we wanna do with our merchants, and then get it to the market quickly. And of course, from a cost perspective, because we design it ourselves, the entry point for the terminal is way lower than with third-party vendors. So you can basically build the right product at lowest cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's attractive to merchants.
That makes sense. Just to jump back to that idea of you outgrowing the market because of that share of merchant wallet that you're able to win. I think the area, the phenomenal success you've had in European online of enabling merchants to sell across a complex European market, that's great. The question I get a lot from investors is there any risk that you're starting to bump up to the limits of merchant penetration in the European online markets? Is there any help you can give us with, did you track that? Are merchants starting to say, "Hey, you know, you're reaching the limits of what volumes we can give you," or?
So far, in the end, we look at it on a global scale. We look at our, let's say, also now we're in planning process for next year. Look at our list of top 100 merchants and see, like, what opportunity is still there to increase share of wallet. And I can assure you that in the top 100, there's so much room to grow, so I don't see that limitation. Of course, there are differences per region. The EMEA still has, I think, a huge opportunity, but for instance, the opportunity in the U.S. is way bigger, also to get more domestic-
Mm-hmm.
Volumes on the platform. I think we have proven in recent years to that we are in a position to grow the U.S. market quite quickly, and that's where on the short term, the focus will be. So I expect most indeed from the U.S. market, but still have significant growth in Europe, also from a significant higher base, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, I think, Peter, and you have said in the past, you imagine exists to challenge the status quo of how things are done, because we shouldn't just accept how things have been done in the past. And one of the status quos has been the accepted wisdom that you get to 70%-80% of the merchant volumes, and that's it, you stop. I think for you, the platform has proven that it's reliable, it doesn't go have downtime. Do you have merchants where you could have that discussion of, there's a benefit to us getting all of your payments, the data that we can share, the experience that you have? Is that a possibility, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the, there's one area where we haven't touched upon in our conversation yet, which is the benefit of working on a single platform and the data that you get.
Mm-hmm.
As a merchant. That's a huge area of investment for us. If you look at retailers, how they want to implement new customer journeys, I think also the pandemic has proven that some moments people buy online, other moments they buy in store. You want to recognize those customers. You want to make sure that customer journeys are optimized, and that's only possible if you have all the volume in a single platform. So with specifically retailers that have a multi-channel strategy, the reason to work with a single vendor is absolutely way higher than maybe on the e-commerce space, where it's maybe easier to route traffic. And even there, I still think, like, there is no reason to have multiple providers, because in the past, the multiple provider thing was around downtime. And I think we indeed have proven that we have very high uptimes, are very reliable partner. So that's not a reason to do it. I think on a, you know, on the digital side, it is more about how to further improve authorization rates, make sure that you get to the highest authorization rates. And that's also an area where we continue to invest in.
And that data side is I guess that's benefit of the single platform, the technology is a big differentiation from vendors who are working with multiple platforms and just can't serve the merchants with that kind of data and analytics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also, like, the way how we use data is, we haven't really talked about our go-to-market strategies, but we basically have three go-to-market strategies. First one is digital.
Right.
That's typically the customers that we've worked for from the start, like Spotify as an example, where it is all about authorization rates. And we use data there to look at fraud prevention, and making sure that we use the data to optimize revenues. So that's a big area. And unified commerce, it's all about improving customer journeys, recognizing customers, but also recognizing customer during the transaction, but also recognizing customers afterwards so that you can make all kind of analysis where shoppers come from, if you've seen them, if you see them in store, if you've seen them online before, that kind of things. And then on the platform side, data is being used to make the right assessment. If you onboard a seller, for instance, if it's potentially a fraudulent seller, or if you want to provide a loan, what the history of this seller is, and if they are good for their money, basically. So that's why we're heavily investing in our data product. And yeah, we're quite confident that that's going to help us to win business. And then in the end, getting back to your question, is it possible to get to 100%? Yes, it is. The only, I think, thing is that we're not active in all geographies yet. So that's where we build out slowly.
Yeah, there's room to geographically and then with the existing people to take a share further. You mentioned, you know, the opportunity in the US earlier. And I think, you know, we looked at Europe. It's a very complex market. When you look at the US, there are fewer payment methods. It looks like it's a more straightforward market. But then in online, to start off with, their growth has been accelerating, and it's now growth at scale. Could you just talk a little bit about the differentiation in what we might have started off thinking was a more commoditized market than Europe and the value you bring to merchants and why that growth has accelerated so much in the last few years?
You mean in the US?
So
I think if you look in the US, like, there are a couple of things that has changed for us. First of all, I think there are more payment methods available right now. So account-to-account payments, buy now, pay later, and retailers want to accept that into their mix. And that's exactly our strength. That's also how we've grown in Europe, because you have all those local payment methods. But it's also another thing, which is our unified commerce strategy. There are not a lot of providers, basically no provider in the US, that can actually have online and in-store payments on the same platform at scale, including all the software around managing those terminals, etc. So a lot of traditional domestic US players, exporting goods, reservation hardware, they see the benefits of this, and they start to work with us. So we expect that this trend will continue, because it is a real benefit to have it in a single platform.
Now, that makes sense. I've got lots more questions. Maybe as we start to come to the end of the session, can I ask the audience, are there any questions from the floor? Take one from the audience. Maybe let's stay on the US market and those in-store volumes. Again, another question, we've discussed this before, but I'd be interested to get a kind of update on your thinking.
Yeah.
Again, it feels like, and maybe this is also a bit more the US than the rest of the world, there's a group of merchants in-store where, you know, it's quite commodity, big grocery chains, et cetera, that maybe Adyen isn't relevant in. And then there needs to be some complexity in payments. Where do you draw the line in terms of splitting the market up in terms of, okay, we're going to be relevant for those merchants because of the value we bring, and actually in those areas we're just not going to play? And how is that changing over time?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question indeed. Like, if you look at the innovation in this space, also with the high volume players, there's a lot going on. I personally really like McDonald's example that we've been working with for some years now. What we do for McDonald's is the in-app payments. So if you want to order something with McDonald's, you go to the app, you order it, and you say which location you want to pick it up, and that payment is then going through our system. It's an online payment, but the actually pickup point is at McDonald's. What you see is that, because people don't like to wait, that they start to order in advance and pick it up. So the volumes at the till, they decline, mm-hmm. and the volumes in app are growing very quickly. So we are now in the fastest growing channel of McDonald's. If you ask me, like, 2-3 years ago, would it be an opportunity to go for the till volume, so the terminal volume of McDonald's, I would say, not really interesting. If you ask me it right now, I would say yes, it is, because what we can provide McDonald's right now, if they would send an RFP, and they haven't yet, but that's my dream, they send the RFP, and then of course, if we would also do the terminals at the till, they can also recognize customers at the till, because they know if they've been in their app before. You can use the payment details to link customers to it, et cetera. Of course, there are all kind of privacy discussions around this, but technically we can do this, and that's the added value that we can bring to retailers. So this is McDonald's as an example. You can also think about groceries. We help a lot of grocery chains with curbside pickup.
Right.
So you're already in their systems now for the digital part of the digital flow of their shopping experience. If that increases over time, and then at a moment in time, you talk about the in-store volume, again, with the data on the back-end side where we're heavily investing in, you get the opportunity to give insights that they normally only would get if people would scan their loyalty card or whatever they need. And I think that's exactly what the area that we're building for. It will take a couple of years to really get those type of volumes on our platform, but I'm convinced that we can, so that we also will. It's a long-term play.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now that makes a lot of sense. And in terms of go-to-market and how you engage with merchants, you've talked a lot about omnichannel as this being a big differentiator for you. Do you go into an online merchant that you've had and say, hey, we can do in-store? How do those discussions happen in terms of, you know, scaling out the business with a merchant? Is there a common pattern, or is it just merchant specific?
It's merchant specific. It's actually quite random. There are retailers that select us to start with in-store, because they say like, hey, we have seen that you have proven yourself online already significantly, so let's first try if in-store really brings the benefits that we hope for. But it's also the other way around. If we do online volume, they've heard that we do in-store, they ask us to test a store, and then they roll out with us. So it's both ways.
That makes sense. Again, a question I get, you're starting to get more from investors, and it comes back to that margin question originally and the kind of structural profitability of the business. As you move more and more into in-store and you get those in-store volumes, first of all, pricing, how does that differ versus online? Traditionally, it's been lower for acquirers. And secondly, when you think about the unit economics of your in-store business, is there a structural difference in how profitable that business would be versus online?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think in general, the way we look at it is more volume based. And of course, most of the volume is still in store. So you get to a higher volume tier, so also lower price per transaction. That's also why we strictly manage on absolute margins with a retailer. Look at the cost price, like the marginal cost of a transaction on our platform is very close to zero. So there is no fundamental difference between the two. And that, of course, helps us to scale the business. Of course, you could argue like a lot of the groceries that are at super low cost deals with traditional providers. It's only about that cost. Also for us, it's hard to compete, because why would we do this, bring a lot of volume on our platform at super low cost if there is no added value that we can bring? It is all about that added value. It's all about that willingness to get insights. And that's also what we want to price for. So our strategy is not to get to the highest volumes possible at the lowest price possible, because also I think because we are an efficiently run company, we could go maybe as low, but it's not in our interest to do so, because we strongly believe that we provide certain added value or insights that we want to get paid for.
So I'm leaving this to the end of the session, but you took me to it by talking about pricing and volume. I'll ask about take rates.
Yeah.
So maybe just to ask, I think one of the concerns was with a drop in the first half of this year. The question I get from investors is, are you having to use pricing to get the volumes because the market's become more competitive or difficult? Have you seen that? Is that what you've been doing, or were there other factors that drove take rates down?
Yeah. So we're not into the market, or we're not going into the market just with price as an instrument. Of course, there are competitive deals on the table, but in general, if you look at the lower take rates over the first half, that's mainly the result of the fact that we get more volume with our bigger merchants. So it's a sign of success,
right,
in combination with the fact that in the first half year, travel came back on our volume or on our platform,
yep.
And travel is this airline acquiring for a significant part, which gets at lower take rates because we don't run the risk, because we don't process the transaction financially.
Perfect. That brings us nicely to the end. Ingo, thank you very much for joining us again. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you very much.